Radio computers online. Archiving 44K. Initiate sequence.
T minus 30 seconds.
Server connection confirmed.
T minus 25 seconds.
Live stream for T120K.
T minus 20 seconds.
Phone lines are go.
T minus 15 seconds.
Satellite uplink verified.
T minus 10 seconds.
Flight check complete. Satellite uplink verified.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here is your host, Leno Sanic.
Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. This is your host, Leno Sanic, and in this segment, we're speaking to William Paris, who knew Mr. Bill Kelly, who unfortunately has passed away. So many researchers have passed away lately. Real sad that the original people who really been carrying the flag have passed away. And welcome to the show, William. I'm so glad you took time out to talk to me about this.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Len.
Okay. Well, I think what we could do is for people who never met Bill or conversed with him, just give us a little insight into what you thought his good attributes were and his contributions to research.
Okay. Well, so I first came across Bill from the Education Forum. He was very, very active there for a long time. I made a post about his passing, and John Simkin made a reply about, he'd made 5,000 posts. I guess not posts, but, comments. That's pretty active. And the thing about Billy was super, super knowledgeable. So I came across his profile and saw, wow, this guy's, right down the road from me. So I reached out to him, and he was very, very generous and responsive. And it very, quickly directed me to some of his writings and such. And that's where I discovered he was a huge music guy and golf. He wrote about golf. He wrote about music, other historical things that piqued his interest too. So it was funny. He wanted to talk to me about music because I'm a musician, and I wanted to talk to him about, Dallas. And so that's, we've probably connected. Definitely before the Pittsburgh. So, maybe 15, 18 years ago, somewhere in that kind of a range. And, he lived in a town, we lived in South Jersey, but Summers Point was the town, that kind of connected us. That was a music town. Here's a little music trivia for you, Len. You're Canadian, correct?
Yeah.
Okay. So do you know much of a history about the band and Robbie Robertson and all those characters?
A little bit. Yeah.
Okay. So you might know then that they were playing a residency in Summers Point, New Jersey, when Bob Dylan called them and said, "Hey, I want you guys to be my backing band and go electric." So that's, and Bill was a big fan of the band. And if you look on his Facebook page, you'll see posts about Garth Hudson and all these, what was going on down there, from a musical standpoint. But what he's left off is what he's left us with are two fantastic blogs. One's JFK Counter Coup and the other's JFK Counter Coup 2. And the great thing about it is, we all want to talk about the books and this book and that book. And, sometimes, a book is a commitment. Bill was great at writing these shorter articles that really were very succinct, well-written and well-researched. So you could go in there, you could go to his blog, you could read two or three articles and really have something to, have something to think about. So I mean, I saw his presentations. I believe he presented in Bethesda, and you know, there was a time where I drove him down to Morley had some sort of press conference, and he needed a ride, so I drove him down. He was my mentor, you know, and I would talk to him consistently. He would come out to my shows, and the thing was, he was such a nice guy. And very, very approachable. And, you know, when there would be me and, you know, some friends at a venue on a set break, and I would talk to him, and, you know, somebody who really didn't know, follow this topic would hear us, you know, Bill would have no problem explaining something or kind of, you know, simplifying some of the technical issues we were discussing. So someone could understand, you know, he was really engaging and was a fun guy, you know, and I learned a lot from him. You know, it just really, you know, like I said, I mean, I just the knowledge that this guy had was just immense. And he was really, one of the things that I did, I would ask him about, you know, these things that happened in the past, but he was really more in, like Morley, he was more interested in moving the ball forward. And, you know, with the Collins radio and the, you know, the Air Force One tapes, all the, you know, the paramilitary activities down in the Keys. I mean, he was still researching, what's the guy, Gene Wheaton, all of these kind of people. He was, you know, he was doing a lot of work to move forward as opposed to, you know, what I would get caught up in was just like talking about the past, you know? So, that, you know, that's a little bit of a snapshot there. And, you know, he did, you know, kind of an interesting, you know, the last, you know, from a career perspective, because we all, you know, have careers, different kind of careers. I mean, I would be, I'd be ecstatic if I could somehow have a career of being a researcher, but, you know, I don't know how I would pay the bills. But he actually, if you know New Jersey, the geography in central New Jersey, there's a huge military base. It's called Joint Base McGuire-Dix or Dix McGuire. Yeah, McGuire-Dix Lakehurst. So they took the old McGuire Air Force Base and combined it with Fort Dix, the Army base, and they made one huge thing out of it. And a few years ago, it was in the news because that's where a lot of the Afghan refugees, when Biden, you know, put them on the planes and they all came here to the United States, they came there for processing. That's kind of the last time that's really, you know, where somebody besides a New Jerseyan would hear about McGuire Air Force Base or Fort Dix. But he spent like the last 10 years up until recently. He worked at the base, and you know, when they were doing exercises and training drills and they needed people to, you know, drive this vehicle and do that and all sorts of different, whatever they needed, you know, some civilian help, you know, to bring in some bodies to help with training. He had a nice run there. I think he might have worked there for upwards of 10 years. So, but so, you know, interesting things. I know his writing career goes back a long time. I was on an email that he'd sent out a year and a half ago. And this was not a JFK related thing. It was more a South Jersey music kind of thing. And it was tied in the 10 other people CC'd on this email. It really had nothing to do. These people weren't researchers. They were his personal friends. You know, I got a little bit of a, you know, insight into some of his personal friends, but that's not really how I knew him. You know, I wouldn't know of his favorite football team or, you know, anything like that. We talked about music a lot and obviously, you know, Dallas, but, how he, you know, I remember, you know, our, communications were around that time where, I think there was a transition from COPA to Kappa, and he was, I guess this was trying to figure out moving forward after his friend John Judge had died, you know, so I communicated with him about that a lot. So he advised me, here, I'll give you an example on some of the things that he advised me. If you're familiar with the New York City, immediate New York City area, you might have heard of Hoboken, New Jersey. A lot of people will know that as the, you know, the birthplace of Frank Sinatra. But it's right across the river. And I lived there for a long time, about 15 years. And when I moved out, I moved to a town called Robbinsville, New Jersey, which is in the immediate Princeton area. And it was around that time that, you know, I was started talking to Bill and asking him different things and saying, hey, you know, what should I look into? What should I research? What do you think I could do? And I remember reading about Nicholas Katzenbach, and he, you know, he was obviously older, and you know, this again, 15 years ago. I can't remember exactly when he died, but I was talking with Bill. I was like, Bill, this guy, it looks like this guy lives like 10 minutes away from me. I should go knock on his door. Maybe, you know, maybe he'll just feel in a good mood of like talking, you know. And, you know, unfortunately, he died. So I never got a chance to do that. Another topic that some research I tried to do that Bill kind of advised me on and steered me. So one of the things that I always tell people about the whole JFK thing is that it's a lot more than just Dallas and, you know, Magic Bullet and the Zapruder film and all that. Once you start digging in, it splinters off. The next thing you know, you're reading about South America or, you know, the Soviet Union and all of these things. And, you know, For instance, I studied history, European history in college, but I never knew about the Berlin operating base after World War II. Right. It wasn't until I started reading about William Harvey that came about. And one day I was reading about this and it referenced a couple names of the people that Harvey had worked with. And, you know, I mean, I wish I was more prepared for this call because I don't have my files out. I can't remember the guy's name.
Oh, that's OK. No problem.
There was a book and it referenced two or three names in the chapter. I was reading it online and I just Googled these guys and one of them was still alive. So I called Bill up. I'm like, Bill, this guy that worked at the Berlin operating base with Bill Harvey is still alive. You know, I should probably contact him. What do you think? He's like, yeah, absolutely. So he gave me a few pointers, maybe some questions to ask and everything. And I called the guy up. He was living in New Mexico. And again, this was probably around 2015, you know, 10 years ago. You know, the guy was really, really hard of hearing. And his wife got on the phone with me and she would kind of, you know, translate a little bit, kind of like she knew how to communicate with her husband, but he was never going to talk to me on the phone. And it was interesting because the guy basically started his career there, you know, World War II intelligence, Berlin operating base. And then he went to like all of the Philippines and everything. And remember, you just recently, what's his name? Sterling Seagrave. You had him on your show recently, right? You re-aired one of those.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. So I was like, oh, my God, the guy that I talked to probably knew about all of that. I mean, he was the head that what is that? The Western Hemisphere, Eastern Hemisphere, whatever, all the Philippines, all of that.
Asia. South Asia.
He was the head of the CIA operating stuff, you know, the facilities out there. So he probably was up to his eyeballs in Marcos and Japanese gold and all of that stuff. He was out there for like 20 years after he'd left, you know, Europe. And, you know, my goal was to see if he had a picture of him and Bill Harvey. Right. Because he wasn't going to tell me anything, you know, operational. We did this and, oh, wow, this was surprising. And, you know, we captured these Russian spies. He wasn't really going to get into that. And what he basically told me, he says, all of my files are organized and I'm giving them to my kids when I'm gone. And that's that. And I'm not going to, you know, give you any information or anything like that. But he was very generous with his time. And, you know, I was able, you know, I just called the guy up and said, look, I'm a private citizen. I've never been published. I have no affiliation with any news outlets or anything. I'm just a guy. Right. And that approach kind of works most of the time when I contact people. But that was really for me, you know, I'm like, oh my God, I'm speaking to this former, you know, CIA bigwig. And, you know, and I'm talking to Bill and he's helping me with some questions and research. And, you know, the goal was simple. You know, I asked, you know, it maybe would have escalated if I.
So he inspired you, Bill inspired you to go further.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you, the big fish that got away. OK, I banged my head on the wall about this one. And again, you know, I mean, I wish Bill had pushed me a little bit harder, but Sprague had an office in Philadelphia right up until he died during COVID. And he was there all the time. And I asked Bill, I'm like, Bill, when's the last time? I'm like, I don't see anybody talking to Sprague about anything. His name's never popping up. He doesn't go to these, you know, the symposiums and the conferences. It's like he's basically walled himself off from everything. And, you know, I mean, Tannenbaum's out here. He's got a high profile, but that's kind of the name. I mean, that's Tannenbaum seems like he would enjoy, you know, I mean, I met him briefly. He's a really powerful, charismatic guy, you know. But so I would ask Bill, I'm like, Bill, you know, the guy's in Philadelphia. Have you ever tried to contact him? And he's like, well, not really. I'm not, you know, the HSCA wasn't so much something that he was, you know, looking into. And I think that, you know, from some topics, you know, have a little more pizzazz, you know. And I think the House Select Committee, the drama, you know, the soap opera of, you know, Tannenbaum and Sprague and then this and that and Blakey, I mean, the mob, it's like, you know, made for TV kind of stuff, you know. And but Bill, that wasn't necessarily, you know, something he was interested in, you know. But I said, you know, I should contact Sprague. And he was like, yeah, you should. And I sat on this for a while. And then when the Philadelphia Eagles won the Super Bowl in February of 2018, they had the massive parade. I went in there and, you know, Sprague's office was open. It was right downtown. And I went in there and I just knocked on the door and walked right in. And his secretary was there. And I explained who I was. Again, I just said, hey, you know, I'm just the citizen, private citizen. And I'm interested in you know, a dynamic of Mr. Sprague's career. And, you know, maybe he'd be willing to talk to me. I left my name and number and everything. And, you know, I was hoping, you know, maybe she would call me back and say, hey, he'll talk to you. But I never got a call back. And then the big mistake was I never followed up. And then Bill should have been like, dude, you're halfway there. You went into the office, you know, you made face-to-face contact with the secretary, the gatekeeper types in law firms. Right. So that, you know, no. That I look back because what happened was I did, after he died, one of the things that Bill and I were talking about this was that maybe Sprague had some files that he'd taken with him when he left. And those really wouldn't be his personal files. That kind of information didn't really belong to him. These files that he accumulated doing research in the employ of the government. I mean, Sprague, everything you read about him seems like right down the middle kind of guy. So, I mean, we assume that he probably didn't take any files with him. He just probably would have been so angry and frustrated with the whole thing that he just walked right out and never looked back. But we both knew that there was certainly the possibility that maybe Sprague did have some files. And, you know, around that time, you'd already had, you know, we'd hit that 25-year mark from the JFK Act and things were starting to, you know, be released. And, you know, we thought maybe if he's got something, he might be, you know, more open-minded to, you know, letting it out. But so I missed that opportunity to talk to him. It was because I wasn't aggressive enough. So I would say,
well, to anyone listening, take your advice, follow through. And that's what, you know,
Well, here's the real kick in the, you know what, Len, is because after he died, I called back and left a message for his son, and his son called me back, and his son was like, oh yeah, Dad loved to talk about the case. We talked about it all the time, because the son actually went to Georgetown University or American, one of the, you know, in the late 70s, he was a college student. And so when his dad came down, he got to spend a lot of time with his dad that he wouldn't have had if his dad was living in Philadelphia and working in Philly. So that was a real, you know. And then I asked the son, I said, you know, would you ever consider talking about, you know, doing an interview or, you know, answering questions about, you know, what you and your dad talked about and some of the things that you believed. And he passed. He said, you know, I'd rather just keep that private conversation between me and my dad. So, I mean, that would be something I could, you know, anyone could try to follow up with him again. He, maybe the son understanding after all of these files coming out and there's new, you know, congressional hearings and all this and that, maybe he might be, yeah, okay, hey. But so that's just kind of a, you know.
All right. Well, let me ask you this. I never really heard what happened to Bill. Was he very ill or?
Well, I'm not exactly sure.
Either. Okay.
The way I found, I hadn't heard from him in about 4 to 5 months. And I was like, oh, I think I'll check in with him. And I, you know, sent an email, left a message, no reply. And then I said, I'll go to his Facebook page. And sure enough, there was a couple posts on his Facebook page from these fellow coworkers in New Jersey announcing that he'd passed away. So I don't know, you know, what it was. I, you know, he's in his mid 70s. So, you know, it could be age related.
Okay.
Unfortunately, I saw the posts and one person said, you know, we'll leave some information about any sort of services. And then from the more recent email where one of his personal friends said, hey, you know, if Bill, you know, he's Catholic, he would have gone to in his town, this would have been the place to go. I called the church and they said, yeah, they just had services for him yesterday. And I was like, oh, I missed that. Yeah.
All right. Well,
but I would.
You mentioned that he was a really nice guy. Can you just give me some instance of you guys driving somewhere or whatever?
So Morley had some sort of press conference that he was doing at the National Press Club in D.C. Again, I think this would have been before COVID. I can't remember if I had a mask on or anything, but Jeff would probably remember. And I think Alan Dale was there. And Alan wrote, if you go to the education forum while we're talking here, I'll find that little page. I think he created a little online memorial. Yeah, I'm looking at it right here. He put it on, he posted it. Yeah, Alan posted on the AARC library.org, you know, he made a little memorial in memoriam. So yeah, I mean, like we drove from New Jersey all the way down to Washington. You know, we left at like whatever 5:36 in the morning. You know, grabbed some bagels, hit the road. You know, listened to some music, talked about what was going to be going on later today with Morley and a couple other people. It escapes me what it was, but I mean, that was a good 9 hours, you know, driving there, driving back. But, you know, the music thing really, really piqued his interest, you know. Summers Point, again, had, you know, that's where like Bill Haley and the Comets and the band actually was the backing band for another musician, a Canadian guy. What was that guy's name? Ronnie Hawkins. Is that him?
Right.
That
Yeah.
So, you know, and this is the kind of stuff that, you know, Bill liked to talk about. And I highly recommend at least you put the links for the Counter Coup, his blogs, because there's some really good stuff there. And one of them, I believe, let me look at the one here. It has.
Just send me any links you want me to put up there.
Yeah, I'll do that.
The Alan Dale thing and he'll put it up there.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's, you know, he was a, you know, golf, not my thing, you know, but, Yeah, so that was my interactions with Bill, and it was hot and heavy sometimes. I mean, we would talk 2, 3, 4 times a week, going back and forth on different stuff, and then I wouldn't hear from him for a couple months. But he would write articles about he reviewed a couple of my band's performances, and he knew a lot. He knew a lot about culture in South Jersey. He was a real resource for that. And even if you want to, so like, for instance, Grace Kelly, right? Her family, I believe was from Philadelphia. They spent a lot of time down in Ocean City during the summers. He knew a lot about that. He was there then. I mean, that was his generation. Grace Kelly was a massive star from the Philadelphia area that spent a lot of time on the Jersey Shore, And he knew a lot about that.
For sure. I'll put any links you have. And of course, the most popular ones are the JFK counter coup and that. And I had him on several times. We talked about the Collins radio and the Air Force One tapes.
Yeah.
Clifton, right?
Yes.
Yeah. That's what people can dig up in the archives.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to make sure that somebody talked about Bill and just gave him a good remembrance because he was there for a long, long time in the community.
And I for me personally, going down this road, I think it's a little more enjoyable when you're part of a team, you're engaging, listening to Black Op Radio, going to symposiums, communicating on Facebook. I'm sure there's plenty of researchers that just stick their nose in and go, do their research and have focus. But, having a mentor, having someone to communicate with, it was, really enjoyable, So for me, very nice Bill to give me his time and take me under his wing and, just such a nice guy. And I have some fond memories, and maybe one of these days, some, 25-year-old kid will be like, oh, can you tell me about the Kennedy assassination? And I'll be like, yeah, I can.
Yeah. Okay. Well, then thank you. I guess we covered everything just at arm's length here. Just trying to remember Bill and your fond memories and his good, easygoing personality.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me on to, talk Do about that. Bill.
All
I'm
right.
sure some people can, hopefully we'll see more comments and more remembrances.
Yeah, send me any links, even to the education forum that you had or that you feel worthy, and I'll just post them in the show notes.
Absolutely. All right, thank you.
All right, William, thank you very much for your time.
All right, take care.
Okay.
You're listening to Black Op Radio.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. This is your host, Len Osanek, and we are speaking to author-researcher Chad Nagel. Hello, Chad.
Hi, Len. How are you doing today?
Good. You had an article that popped up at Kennedy's and King. You mentioned a couple of weeks ago, maybe 3 weeks ago, but I want to make sure that I give you time to discuss it and bring it to people's attention. I think, any researchers will be wanting to hear from what went into an article, and especially if it's at Kennedy's and King.
Well, thanks, Len. Yeah, I mean, Kennedy's and King sort of is a great outlet for doing deep dives because it's you're not circumscribed by word limits and you can really just kind of give vent to analysis and just go all out. And this was a good format and Jim DiEugenio liked it. And I thought that, it's an issue that's always kind of haunted me since I first read about it in John Newman's in the second edition of his book, Oswald and the CIA. And then when I read up further on my own and looked into the primary documents, the primary sources, I thought, that's really strange. And the latest development in this story, doesn't really dispel the mystery anymore. In fact, I think it, if anything, it deepens it, but essentially it involves what's come to be known as Oswald's missing letter, which is a letter that Lee Harvey Oswald claimed he wrote. He himself claimed he wrote while he was living in the Soviet Union to the U.S. Embassy in December of 1960. Okay. And, John Newman first really fleshed this out. And he kind of in that book brings it almost completely up to date already all those years ago. Except that now we have the actual, what purports to be the actual letter. And I'll just give you some background as to how I came across it. You'll remember in October of last year, Representative Ana Paulina Luna, who heads up the declassification task force in Congress, she was in touch with the Russian embassy. She had been in touch with the months before. She had actually gone with some other members of Congress and staff to the embassy here in Washington. But she was going to inquire about getting hold of surveillance files of the Soviet KGB on Lee Harvey Oswald during the time that he lived in the USSR. And so they talked to her, they liked her, and they said, yeah, you know, we're planning to publish something soon, and, you know, we'll be in touch. Well, come October of last year, they delivered to her office. I'm not sure whether it was on Capitol Hill or down in Florida because we had a government shutdown. I think they might have brought it to her district office down there. They brought her this loose leaf binder, which was, I counted 386 photocopied pages of documents from the Russian archives. But this was not, and it is not, the KGB surveillance files, which Judge John Thunheim, in his testimony to Congress on May 20th last year, said stood about 5 feet high off the ground. And he thought he had secured agreement from the Russians to get those for when the Assassination Records Review Board was in session, but at the last minute it fell through for whatever reason. I think they might have asked for some money. It was like $100,000, and the ARB was already struggling for funds, so that was kind of out of the question. And that's not what we got in October. What we got was something the Russian government published, which was an analysis of JFK's assassination and how it affected Soviet-American relations. And that's actually the name of the publication, which they published in a hard volume, a hard copy bound volume. They did not put it online. And it's called The Assassination of U.S. President John F. Kennedy and Soviet-American Relations. Okay. And it's a mixture of like official documents, correspondence between the Soviet government and the U.S. government and within the Soviet government about different things connected to the assassination. Part of it is deliberations about whether to allow Lee Harvey Oswald to remain in the Soviet Union. And that reached the highest level of government. That was like discussed at the Politburo level. And then a lot of it is correspondence with the U.S. government, because the Soviet government, said, we'll give you all the assistance we can. They were very sensitive that they might be accused, because Oswald had lived in the Soviet Union, that the Soviet Union would be accused of having carried out the assassination. And they were very sensitive to that. So they sort of bent over backwards to try to assist. So that's what we got. And JFK Facts, which I write for a lot, sent me down to Tampa, to her district office. And I went there and I sat there and I scanned 386 pages with my phone. And it was a good thing that I could plug it in, because the battery would definitely have burnt out. I'm scanning these documents as quickly as I can, and I don't really have time to read them, but I did come across that letter. And I saw that it was supposed to be from Lee Harvey Oswald, and it was dated December 1st, 1960. And I thought, well, I'll read this later. But, just scanning it quickly, it was only like a page and a half or whatever. I could see that it didn't look terribly, earth shaking. Nothing in it looked particularly sort of groundbreaking. There was nothing new in there. But anyway, I resolved to go and look at it later. And so back in my hotel room, I'm putting this massive PDF thing into a format that it can be sent to Washington, because the congresswoman, because the government was shut down, no government agency would publish it. The archives was closed. There was nobody to man the website. So they said, she said, would you please make it available for free to the public, which is what JFK Facts did the following day. So I think it was on the, no, well, she got it on the 14th. I scanned it on the 15th. So by the 16th, it was up on the site and anyone could look at it in Russian, of course. I mean, you can't read Russian. It was maybe a bit of a challenge there. But so when I went back to look at the, because I knew from reading John Newman's book that this was an issue. And I looked at it, I read it, and what it concerns is Oswald wrote to the US Embassy and he inquired about what would be needed to what the procedure was for coming back to America. Now, according to the official history, the Warren Report, he never made any inquiry about that before February of 1961. But the thing is, in that letter of February 1961, he himself writes that you haven't answered my letter of December 1960. So for the Warren Commission and the HSCA and others to sort of defensively say, no evidence that he ever tried to contact anybody before February 1961 is a little strange. And I mean, I tend to think, John Newman, has a case, especially after he cited all of the documentation, CIA documentation showing that they themselves had encountered a letter dated December 1960. But anyway, to get to that later, I started to read the Russian dossier, and the Russian dossier has a it consists of numbered documents. They've numbered them. So document number 61 is actually written by the head of the KGB to the deputy foreign minister. And it says the final paragraph on page 164 of this dossier says, in December 1960, Oswald began correspondence with the U.S. Embassy in Moscow, seeking to return to America. And to resolve this question, the American consulate invited him to Moscow. And then it skips to the next sentence, says, in June 1961, Oswald and his wife visited the embassy and began the process of leaving the USSR. They kept their intentions secret from their acquaintances. Well, if you go then into the sort of, there's like a kind of addendum or appendix, and documents 6-1, 6-2, and 6-3 are the letter itself. One of them is the envelope, and the other two are the 2 pages of the letter itself. And it just says, dear sirs, I'd like information concerning, it's got, some fairly typical Oswald spelling errors, my position in regard to my American citizenship, particularly the question of returning to the United States and settlement of any legal problems which hold consequence for me if I did desire to return to America. It's, and there's a couple more paragraphs, but it's just, I'd like this correspondence kept confidential. I got bad publicity in October 1959 when I applied to dissolve my US citizenship, and that only aggravated the situation. Well, the whole idea that Oswald started corresponding with the US Embassy in December 1960, it contradicts the official US history. The Warren Report says the American Embassy in Moscow received a letter from Oswald postmarked Minsk, February 13th, 1961. Oh, it's actually postmarked February 5th. And then they stamped received it February 13th, 1961. Okay. And he asked that he be readmitted to the United States in February 1961. And then they say this was the first time that the embassy had heard from or about Oswald since November 16, 1959. I find it very peculiar that they would go the extra distance and put that extra sentence in there. It's like, okay, well, you've said that the first time he did was February 13th. Why do you feel the need to rub it in? And they include Oswald's letter of February 1961 in the Warren Report. So it's volume 17, Commission Exhibit 931. And it begins, dear sir, since I have not received a reply to my letter of December 1960, I'm writing again asking that you consider my request for the return of my American passport. I mean, that right there, I mean, why should we assume that you know, Oswald was hallucinating or lying. I mean, he said himself that he had already tried to contact them and he didn't get an answer. And Snyder did answer, so the U.S. consul did answer him on February 28th, 1961, saying, "We've received your recent letter concerning your desire to return to the United States, but your earlier letter of December 1960, which you mentioned, does not appear to have been received at the embassy." So, you know, I mean, we don't know what happened. Oswald's living in the Soviet Union. His mail is all mail from him and to him internationally is clearly being read, at least by us. But everything is surely being read by the Soviet intelligence as well. I mean, you know, you would expect any American defector living and working in the USSR to be monitored pretty closely all the time. So no real surprise, but the idea that he wrote a letter and it didn't get to the embassy, what happened to it? Okay, so this letter purports to be that letter. And the Warren report sort of continues defensively about this letter, saying that in February 1961 he referred to a previous letter which he said had gone unanswered, and then there is evidence that such a letter was never sent. I mean, do you really need to say that? It's very peculiar, in my opinion. And the evidence that it presumably is referring to is Oswald's so-called historic diary, which is Commission Exhibit 24. And there's an entry in there for February 1st that reads, "Make my first request to American Embassy Moscow for reconsidering my position. I stated I would like to go back to the U.S. So he's supposedly, in his historic diary, he's saying it was February 1st, 1961, that he made his first request to the U.S. Embassy. So again, I mean, this must be what the Warren Commission is referring to. You see, it's February, so nothing due in December 1960 that's clearly, you know, wrong. I mean, what, you know, why would he say that? I mean, maybe he was lying and saying, you know, look, I already made a request and now you really have to hurry up and answer me. I mean, I doubt it. I think he probably did make a request and nobody ever saw the letter. I think probably Snyder never saw it, you know, the consul in the U.S. Embassy. But, you know, what's interesting is if you go back in time and look at the calendars for these years, you know, it's postmarked February 5th, you know, and that was a Sunday. And even in the Soviet Union, which did not observe a sort of Lord's Day, post offices were closed. So if somebody was in there stamping letters, postmarking letters, I think that would be a little bit strange. So, but anyway, so this letter basically surfaced in 1991. So this was really shortly before the Soviet Union collapsed, about a month before, and it was ABC News Nightline with Ted Koppel. You know, for those who are old enough to remember that, I remember it quite well. And they had an episode, and John Newman covers this in his book. It's Investigation, the KGB Oswald Files. And the narrator is saying that, you know, in the final year of USSR's existence, the KGB showed Nightline's reporters this December 1960 letter and said, you see, people speculated that he never wrote it, but, you know, it still exists in the Russian Oswald file. But they never showed it on screen. They just talked about it. They showed the February letter on screen. You know, it was a typical ABC Nightline thing. So there was still some question, you know, where is this thing? And so now with the Russian dossier that the Russians provided to Luna, we can see this, you know, a photocopy of the envelope and its two-page contents for the first time. And so this is what we've got. Now, between the time that ABC Nightline did its thing and the time that, long before the time that that John Newman wrote his analysis of it, the ARRB declassified a CIA memorandum. John Newman had already seen this, but his book, I think, came out in 1992. I mean, he'd already seen it, but I don't think it had been publicly totally declassified until July 1993. And it was a memorandum, an internal memorandum sent by the CIA's counterintelligence chief, the guy that replaced James Angleton, whose name was George Galaris. And he wrote a memo to the deputy director of operations. I confess I don't know what his name was. And it was September 18th, 1975, and it referred to the CIA having opened a personality file, this 201 file, we call it, on December 9th, 1960. But what Kolaris wrote was that the CIA had opened that file in response to Oswald's queries, his word, about coming home. Now, the official line was always no. The 201 file was opened because the US State Department asked the CIA for information on American defectors in the Soviet Union. It has nothing to do with Oslo. But here you have the CIA counterintelligence chief saying that that's why. Now, why did he write that? I mean, we don't know. But that 1975 memo was shared with the House Select Committee on Assassinations, the HSCA. So it was written in 1975, and then at some point during the HSCA's existence, they got a copy of the letter, and they presumably also got another memo, another CIA memo that was written, I think, about 5 months later. It's dated March 9th, 1976, and this is sort of this one omits any mention of Oswald's, December 1960 inquiry. It just says it was opened because there was a list of American defectors of the USSR that was given to the Department of State, and that's what prompted, the opening of the 201 file. So remember, the date of Oswald's letter is supposed to be December 1st, 1960. The date that the 201 file was opened was December 9th, 1960. So it looks very close. It really does look as if the CIA might have opened the 201 file on the basis of him, starting to ask questions about coming home. But that's not what the CIA wanted anybody to believe. They buried it there. And then later on, still, there's an undated memo that really tries to kind of hammer home the point. And it's called, this particular memo is called something like notes on, I can't remember, but it says definitely the statement from a CIA staff is inaccurate. Okay, I mean it, and then it asterisks it at the bottom. Oswald did not make inquiries about returning to the United States until early February 1961, 2 months after a 201 was opened on him. Again, I mean, that seems very strange to me. How do you know he didn't make any inquiries? I mean, he said he made an inquiry. You never saw the letter. That doesn't mean he didn't make them. It means that if he made them, the letter disappeared. It was intercepted. It was not forwarded, what have you. But this is like the CIA backpedaling and trying to kind of, I don't know, CYA. That's what the CIA looks like it's doing, covering their ass. I mean, it's very peculiar. It's very defensive, on the back foot type of thing. And as John Newman notes, the HSCA shut down the all discussion of this issue about whether Oswald sent any letters to the US Embassy before February 1961 and concluded in its final report, there is no indication that Oswald expressed to any US government official an intention to return to the United States until mid-February 1961. I mean, to go to all this trouble seems very strange to me. I'll say why in a bit. But basically, they just kind of err on the side of being able to say they're telling the truth because they say that Oswald expressed to any U.S. government official an intention. Well, if no U.S. government official, like somebody at the embassy, like Richard Snyder, received a letter from him, then they can say, yeah, he never expressed it to any U.S. government official because no U.S. government official received it. But no indication does feel a little bit extreme. Okay, and what John Newman writes in the chapter entitled "The Riddle of Oswald's 201 File," He writes about the Kolaris memo. He says the HSCA was unwilling to draw a firm conclusion, and in the end, they abandoned the issue, insinuating that it was because of the CIA's refusal to turn over the internal routing sheets. In the absence of dissemination records, this is the HSCA's words, the issue could not be resolved. Okay, so basically they just dismissed Kolaris's own memo saying this was the reason we opened the 201 file, right? That had to be buried. And again, they buried Oswald's own, you know, letter, writing, where he said, yeah, I tried to contact you in December 1960. So it's the double, you know, cover-up attempt here, it looks like. So the question is, was this a bureaucratic error or was this a deliberate, you know, attempt to cover something up? And I mean, I don't think that the CIA deserves the benefit of the doubt on this. I certainly don't think that the Warren Commission does. And I think the HSCA had so many problems that, you know, it's not, I mean, it didn't reach a credible conclusion. So then the issue becomes, and I want to say, I mean, ordinarily I would not mention his name, but Warren Report defender and CIA apologist Fred Litwin did write an article very quickly on his blog about this letter. So it was actually dated October 18th, so 2 days after JFK Facts put it on the site for download. He wrote this thing, and I'll get into it in a minute. He draws a conclusion based on assuming that this letter is a forgery. And he says that he's proven something based on this letter being a forgery. He hasn't, but I'll explain that in a second. But there are aspects of this letter that look like it, you know, it might not be authentic. There are things like there's a Cyrillic letter in there in place of the Latin alphabet letter that has the same sound. There's his signature, which, you know, Lee Harvey Oswald didn't often write his whole name out. He usually just put Lee Oswald or Lee H. Oswald. So when he spelled out Harvey, and the few times I can find it, the E is pretty, in Harvey, is pretty legible. I mean, you can see it there. And this one, it's not. It looks like H-A-R-V-Y. And this is something that Fred Litwin pointed to immediately. He said the handwriting, not only does the handwriting look exactly the same as the mysterious Dear Mr. Hunt letter that is, you know, appeared in the mid-1970s and is dated November 8, 1963. It has the same signature. It also has the same opening words. I would like information concerning sick my position. So concerning is misspelled in the same in both ways. And, you know, I suppose supporting this letter's authenticity, the December 1st, 1960 letter, is that, you know, apart from Oswald himself having referred to it, he had dyslexia. He wrote inconsistently. He spelled inconsistently. So, I mean, I don't think that there's that, you know, I don't think that you can just necessarily point to hand. It roughly resembles his handwriting, but it might not be. But what I thought was interesting was that of the three documents that make up this letter, one is the envelope and two are the two pages. The envelope, which is filled out in Russian, so Cyrillic alphabet handwriting, that does look like Oswald's other Cyrillic handwriting. I mean, I did like, I'm you know, I am not a professional handwriting analyst, but there are clear idiosyncrasies in there that make it look as if Oswald did actually fill out, you know, that Oswald addressed the envelope to the U.S. Embassy. I don't know what that means, but I don't think Fred Litwin bothered to look at the envelope. I think he just looked at the contents. And he said, well, his point was that, and this is, he titled his article, Soviet File Given to Luna Proves a KGB Operation. Okay. And what he said was that the Mr. Hunt letter of November 8th, 1963, because it appeared sort of during a period of U.S. government reinvestigation into the assassinations. We had the Church Committee and we had the HSCA. He said it was an attempt by Soviet intelligence to link Oswald to U.S. intelligence, to the CIA, and thereby associate him with our intelligence agencies in a disinformation operation. So, and that would, by the way, also deflect suspicion from the notion that Oswald had any relations with the Soviet KGB, and which is perfectly possible, by the way. But he says, you know, it begins with the same opening words: "I'd like information concerning my position." The two paragraphs are not identical, which he says. The opening paragraph in our letter from December 1960 is longer. But he says this letter proves that the Dear Mr. Hunt letter was a KGB operation. They forged the writing, language, and spelling of the 1960 Oswald letter to try and prove that E. Howard Hunt and thus the CIA was tied to the JFK assassination. I mean, this makes no sense on one very, very important level. First of all, we don't really know if this letter is a forgery, the December 1960 letter, which it may be. We don't know when it first appeared. I mean, we heard about it in November 1991, thanks to ABC News Nightline, but we didn't see it. This is the first time we've actually seen it. So for him to say they forged the writing, language, and spelling of the 1960 Oswald letter to prove E. Howard Hunt and thus the CIA was tied to the assassination, that makes no sense without knowing when this letter first appeared. If this was a KGB disinformation operation, then possibly, the letter found its way into the hands of George Collaris, the CIA counterintelligence chief, and then he wrote his memo saying, oh, look, you know, Oswald inquired about coming home in December 1960, and we opened a 201 file. That's what he said. He might have written that, okay, not based on this letter, but based on having read Oswald's February 1961 letter, where Oswald himself says that, you know, that he wrote, started writing in 1960. But Collaris wouldn't have just relied on that February 1961 letter, would he, without having actually seen the December 1960 letter? So anyway, it's possible that this was KGB disinformation, but it's also possible it was very defensive because the Soviets were still very paranoid that, you know, especially after the Warren Commission issued its report and the Soviets basically rejected it. They said, you have to be kidding, you know, lone gunman, come on, give us a break. They didn't. There's only one notable Russian kind of source for that belief, and that's Oleg Nechiporenko's Passport to Assassination, which was published in 1992. And nobody else, his colleague in the KGB and the Soviet embassy, consistently wrote there's no way that Oswald could have done that. He also claimed that he encountered Oswald in the Soviet embassy in Mexico City. So the official line from the Soviets has always been not credible. Sorry, we don't buy it. Same as Charles de Gaulle didn't buy it. I mean, this is what happened. So I don't know how much detail I should go into with Mark Lane, because as you know, Mark Lane was accused of being a kind of a KGB, you know, a paid agent or whatever. I've never thought that was credible, but that's the type of thing that people like Fred Littman want to say. Anyone who criticizes a Warren report is a KGB agent.
You know? Well, you know? I mean, you're losing me when you said Fred Littman. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah, just, I said I wouldn't mention his name.
Total fraud, right?
Yeah, he whose name shall go unmentioned here. But anyway, one thing I do want to say is that the assumption that the Dear Mr. Hunt letter of November 8th, 1963 was addressed to E. Howard Hunt, the CIA officer, and not H.L. Hunt, the JFK-hating Texas oil man, that's never been established. We don't know who Mr. Hunt is. And everyone knows H.L. Hunt despised the Kennedys. And a lot of people think that, you know, Big Oil had some kind of hand in it. I mean, the point is we don't know. So any assumption that Mr. Hunt in the Dear Mr. Hunt letter is E. Howard Hunt is per se a leap and a presumption. So I mean, essentially that's where it more or less stands. I think it's worth noting that the Dear Mr. Hunt letter roughly coincides with the date of George Collaris's internal memorandum. Okay. So it's possible that both the December 1960 and November 1963 letters originally surfaced in the US at the same time, assuming that they're both forgeries, and that the December 1960 letter was simply totally suppressed. But I mean, the fact that it's appeared in this Russian dossier shouldn't necessarily be assumed as some sort of Russian provocation today, because the Russian government now, the leaders of the Russian government, were all children at the time of the assassination. They probably aren't terribly interested in it, but I do think this letter was resided in their archives, and I do think that that the KGB chairman's report to the foreign ministry, to the Soviet foreign ministry, after the assassination, where he's giving a kind of chronology of Oswald's life, he says that he started to correspond with the US Embassy in December 1960. He doesn't refer to this letter, but he probably did write that. And all that says to me is, yeah, probably this letter was intercepted by the Soviet KGB. But because all of his letters would have been intercepted, the Soviet KGB, his apartment was bugged and everything else. So my sort of assumption is that Oswald's correspondence and communication were being monitored by both the CIA and the KGB. I think that's a very reasonable, assumption to make. H.T. Lingle under James Angleton was definitely reading all of his mail to and from the Soviet Union. There's no question about that. That's not even disputed. But what if, because of this envelope situation, you're left with this strange kind of scenario where the letter was removed and then it was from the envelope and was perhaps, copied, or then it or that it was replaced with something and then perhaps sent on. And if that's the case, and someone in the US Embassy, some CIA person in the US Embassy looked at it closely and said, "This isn't Oswald's handwriting," then yeah, then they might try to suppress it for some reason. I don't really know why they would be so sensitive, especially today, about admitting that, yeah, I mean, Oswald's mail was being read by the Soviet KGB while he was in the Soviet Union. I mean, that's not an outrageous thing to say, especially in light of the fact that the contents of this particular letter are so innocuous. But that leads me to think that maybe the letter was replaced and sent on. It's not, I don't think, common for it was not then, and it still would not be if they did it today, for you to take a defector's mail, steam open the envelope or whatever you do, take it out, copy it, and then put it back in and send it on. I mean, you're going to send it on, right? You're not going to just make it disappear. That's going to arouse suspicion. So, what were they doing? I mean, did Oswald start asking about, because remember, he hadn't even been in Minsk a year by December 1960. He only arrived there in January 1960. So in less than a year, he's already asking about coming home. And for one reason or another, this is not something that the CIA wanted anyone to think. Okay, they just did not want anybody to entertain that notion. So that's why, I mean, really, the letter just deepens a mystery that already existed. It would be very, very interesting still to get a hold of those, surveillance files on Oswald that the Russians still have. I might add, by the way, that Norman Mailer, who wrote a sort of a kind of a Warren Report defense lone gunman book in the mid-90s, I can never remember the name. It's either Oswald's Ghost or has Ghost in the title. So he was given an advance by Random House here in America, and I think he got $20,000 in the mid-90s. And as far as I understand, he used that in part to bribe former KGB, Soviet KGB officials to give him some of these surveillance files. So if you read that book, which I haven't, you're treated to a bunch of like recordings of Oswald arguing with Marina at home and, you know, recordings of Oswald in conversation. And they were transcribed in that book. But by no means is that the bulk of the Soviet KGB recordings and wiretaps and reports as well. I mean, they had lots of informants who were Oswald's friends and they informed on him. They had all kinds of stuff and we just haven't seen it. So, I mean, it almost looks to me as if including this letter in the dossier that is now published on the National Archives website is, you know, let's say that it's not just a matter of publishing it because it happened to be in the archives and they wanted to put this out there, but that it has some political objective, then it's a political objective that is designed, I think, to draw us into a deeper dialogue politically, because the Russian government doesn't have many governments to really talk to in the West now. They're very sort of, you know, cut off. And they look for whatever dialogue they can. And after all, we do still have diplomatic relations with them. So the ambassadors will step up. But again, I mean, I don't know what the letter means. I just know that it's the most recent iteration of the ongoing mystery that John Newman wrote about in his book Oswald and the CIA, and so I don't know why the U.S. authorities would go to great lengths to insist that Oswald never even tried, because to do that, you know, to insist that he never tried to contact the U.S. embassy before February of 1961. I mean, what difference does it make? What if you said, yeah, we accept that he probably tried, but we just never got the letter. I mean, is that like you're accusing the Soviets of intercepting his mail? That's not a big accusation. It's very strange. I mean, it doesn't make a lot of sense, but I just thought, you know, people who are interested in this issue and the assassination generally and Lee Harvey Oswald, the continuing enigma and puzzle of Oswald, might be interested to have a full historical deconstruction of the letter. So that's basically it. I mean, I
good.
Think that
very good. It. Well, I'll make links to the article at Kennedy's and King then.
Yeah, thanks. And as I say, if anyone wants to kind of add anything to it, I mean, I think it really all it does is really make us want the Soviet KGB surveillance files on Lee Harvey Oswald even more. I mean, that's what this letter accomplishes. And, you know, it would be interesting, by the way, if the CIA would care to comment about this particular letter now, over 65 years after Oswald supposedly wrote and sent it. You know, I mean, why don't they come out and say, yeah, that's a forgery or something, you know what I mean? It's like, it's one of those things that lingers in the background, but, and yeah, so I got drawn into it and Jim DiEugenio was receptive. So I'm happy about that.
Yeah, very good. Thanks for doing the work and research on it.
You bet.
It's
nice to talk, Len. And
yeah, the thing I feel about it, which is a little negative, is when I stand back and I go, well, I know Lee Oswald didn't do it. So the, you know, trying to figure out why that the State Department or the CIA or the, you know, Warren Commission would cover up something, it's kind of like, well, it's all part of their deception. You know, just, you know, like, to the nth degree, there's nothing they wouldn't do to muddy the waters in that. And this is just another one of those things. Oh, by the way, Oswald's Tale is the Norman Mailer book.
That's it.
Oswald's Ghost is I think a video by Dan Rather and Norman Mailer was in it, and a few other, you know, what was it? It might have been like an ABC or it was on TV, I think.
Okay. I must have got those confused.
But yeah.
Anyway, I haven't read, you know, the Norman Mailer thing, and
I did. You know, and Norman, it's Mailer, awful. You know, they gave him a lot of money. I heard an awful lot of money, and I heard that from Fletcher Prouty.
20 grand. Yeah, 20
grand. No. What I heard, it was more like $1 million.
Wow.
Well, and that was way back then, and they just said, here, take this money, probably from USAID, and go there and write something. And then he wrote it, and then whoever edited it was able to, like, just change whatever they wanted to change, and that was that. And he got the money, and he got a free trip out of it. And, you know.
I mean, this was a time when, you know, in the mid-90s, I mean, Soviet society was so degraded and collapsed. It was really horrific, actually. I was sort of traveling around that part of the world a lot, sort of in different capacities, when I did human rights and I did kind of market research. It was so appalling. You can't even imagine how awful it was. The whole society collapsed. People were desperate. You know, if Norman Mailer went over there and started handing out money or offering money, he could have probably bought a lot with not very much. So if he was paid that much, then he didn't just break even. I mean, he made out like a bandit. And I heard that his career was sort of suffering at that particular time. It was in a bit of a nadir, or a bit of a lull. But I mean, at the end of the day, the only thing that really puzzles me is why the Warren Report and the HSCA would have gone to such lengths to try to just kind of bury the idea that Oswald asked about, you know, that he tried to. And why can't they just say, well, we just never got the letter? I mean, that's what Richard Snyder said. But they went further and said, no, there's no evidence that he tried to. Well, he said he did. I mean, that's evidence right there. He wrote it, and nobody questions the authenticity of that letter. I question the authenticity of this particular letter that the Russians have produced, and the letter that, you know, the Dear Mr. Hunt letter. I mean, I do think that they look, you know, fabricated. But the point is, it doesn't really matter. I mean, the contents of the December letter that we have, that the Russians have produced, is innocuous. There's nothing really different about it. It's just a normal inquiry about what do I need to do about coming home, which we saw in the February letter. So what I think is that this 201 file issue is, you know, very sensitive. They were immediately sensitive about the idea that they'd open a 201 file based on his inquiries about coming home, as opposed to the State Department asking the CIA for all its information on American defectors. I mean, I'm genuinely perplexed by that.
Which leads to the defector program.
Yeah. The defector program, which you know, Otto Atepka was on to, and he was clearly making some tracks in there. But the, you know, our investigations, you know, our official investigations in this country, I mean, it's so embarrassing. I mean, it's like, this is the best you guys could come up with? And then there's this entry in the historic diary. I mean, that's it. Why would he write in his letter that he'd already tried to contact the embassy? Makes no sense. You know, and it's like they're trying to say, well, we don't want to raise suspicion that the Soviets were, you know, reading his mail. Really? I mean, who believes that? So, I mean, I would like to, you know, I really do wish that it were more viable to, you know, to go and make inquiries of the Russian government and so forth. But
I'd like to make inquiries to the American government.
Well, I would too. Although we've made a lot of those, but I mean, you know, FOIA, they always sort of fob you off on FOIA, you know, Freedom of Information Act, and Freedom of Information Act does not govern requests related to the JFK assassination. It's supposed to be governed by a different statute. It doesn't matter. They still put you off. I've had this happen to me with the CIA and the FBI. It's like, no, you got to fill out the FOIA thing. And then you have to wait like at least a year or something.
I think Fletcher told me a group of retired admirals and generals that meet to discuss the validity of these requests and how they're going to handle it, or how are they going to answer it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean,
the fraud of that, you know, so the, you know,
Yeah, I mean, I was so my co-author on this piece is Finnish, and he lives in Helsinki, and he's fairly new. When the Finnish security services, right, their like intelligence agency, their main one, released their Oswald file in December of 2023, that was exactly 60 years, and they had this. That's what their law says: 60 years from the date of, you know, that it's put into our archives, that it's classified, we're going to release it. And they did. And I have to say, whatever faults you may find with any other countries, when they have some law and it's about that, they do release it on time. We don't. We sort of like hem and haw. No, we have to postpone it. And no, it's got to be done. And, you know, it's like, do you people even read most of this stuff? A lot of the redactions that were lifted have nothing sensitive underneath them. I mean, you know, I can imagine these security types sitting around and deliberating over individual FOIA requests, but I mean, I don't have any confidence. I don't even have confidence that they really are thinking about it. You know, there's no money involved. There's no, you know, promotion involved or anything. So it's just sort of, you know, keep it under wraps. And
well, George Joannidis got a promotion.
Yeah. Yeah, George Joannidis got a medal. You know, he got a very prestigious medal, and you know, that I think was a significant breakthrough. Was the revelations in that personnel file? And by the way, that personnel file is not even complete. I mean, you can go through it and you can see, well, there are pages I can't read. There's clearly stuff missing, and that's a normal thing. I mean, we got a 201 file from a Cuban exile as well last year. And it's also clearly not complete. So they take stuff out and then they, I don't know, they make stuff illegible. There's a ton of stuff in the archives that has photos that you can't look, you can't see because.
It's right. Just, and then you find like the person you mentioned, that these people are paid to write and keep waving the flag of the Warren Commission in my government, right or wrong. And yeah, they got it right. I mean, it's the poverty of that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I know. Yeah.
Well, okay. Well, we should wrap it up. And I just want to make sure that people know about your article. And if they are interested in this topic, to go further and read what you've written, what you've researched and dug up. And it's, you know, probably a narrow bandwidth. But if you are interested, there people have, you know, like down the rabbit hole and said, here's what we found here. Here's what we found here. The Russians have released some stuff. Here's what they have. But yeah.
And there is more interesting stuff in that Russian dossier. It's just not what we were hoping for or expecting. I mean, that's basically what I can say. I mean, I've looked through it. It's got a lot of interesting documents in there. The Soviets thought the lone gunman conclusion was bunk, and they were right. And that's what it is. It's a historical dossier. It's not the surveillance files on Oswald, which we would like to complete that chapter of his short life.
Will, in my opinion, just prove that he was not, you know, the assassin, you know, and he was a low-level guy on an assignment to go in there and live there for a year and make a report back of what's going on.
Yeah, and we still don't even know how he got his visa so quickly and how he got into Finland.
Well,
so
you know what I mean? It kind of self-explains itself. Like, how could you normally, oh, well, there's the hands of, you know, somebody is babysitting him and shepherding him around.
Well, I mean, the funny thing is, you probably know, when he actually entered the Soviet Union from Finland, the CIA had a lot of very intense kind of active measures and programs directed against the Soviet embassy there. Like intelligence, there's like, I don't know, half a dozen or more different CIA programs. And one of them was involved getting students into the Soviet Union, you know, and legally. So they would recruit these students who are graduate students and send them in with an understanding that they were going to do something when they were there. But these people had like Fulbright scholarships, and they came from places like, you know, they had some kind of a year at Oxford. You know, they were like serious academic pedigree. And along comes good old Lee Harvey, the high school dropout, you know, took an early discharge from the Marines, and he gets in under that wire. You know, I mean, it's very strange. And there's no record of him in Finland at all, except for one guy who said he shared a train cabin with him, and he died last year. And he only remembered because he reread his diaries in the 1980s and saw that he described meeting Lee Harvey Oswald. Can you imagine? No one else. He was there for 5 days. Nobody in the Finnish government, any travel agents, any nobody remembered running into him, even in the hotels. There's no account of that. And that's why it's so suspicious, because this was long before anybody had thought of assassinating JFK, who wasn't even president yet. But they still had to cover up the circumstances of Lee Harvey Oswald's movements through Finland and into the Soviet Union. So, I mean, that the omission tells you more than the, you know, what they say, as usual. But anyway, thanks
again. Okay, Mr.
again.
Nagel. Yeah, thank you very much for sharing your time and research. And we'll talk again.
Okay, Len.
All right. Okay, good night.
Take care. Bye.